Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Behavioral Health Integration episode. This will be part two on improving the global health system with Dr. Ryan Paul. Now, let's get started.
I mean, we've created this, right? So it's always interesting to me when I watch social media, we're complaining about the wrong things. We're saying, oh, the big bad wolf is stealing from us. Well, yeah, it's because you're spending half of your day bitching and moaning about it on social media, right? So if an independent and small institution says, well, we need to fix this, and they could be a private sector one, I say, well, what have you done to fix it? What's your specialty? Do you have a specific patient population that you are better at taking care of than the guy next door? And the answer is always no. We just want people to show up. We want to dispense. We want to make money. We want people to pay us more. Well, the system's not set up to do that. The system is set up to take from you, right? The system is not set up for rural healthcare and the small guy to win. It's no different than the conversation between Main Street and Wall Street, right? In other sectors. It's built that way. Yet the very people that don't want that to happen won't get on board with me as it relates to universal healthcare, right? And consistency in reimbursement and removing clawbacks and direct enumeration fees in the pharmaceutical or the gap in opportunity, right? For private practice physicians to be reimbursed at the level that they should because they're really good at what they do. And they end up having to sell their practice to the big health system, right? So that they can survive. And they say, we don't like this system, but then they fight for it because they certainly don't want a socialized medicine system because that's certainly not going to work, right? But what we do know is that clinicians have a better quality of life. No, you're probably not going to be a millionaire as a primary care clinician, but there are other things you can do if you want to be a millionaire. And so we decide, right? We decide what our calling is. And that can be, and I think that people might think that that's a little presumptuous, and maybe even a little arrogant to say. But again, I come back to this idea that we can remove the motive of profit from healthcare. And then let's go back to addiction treatment and mental health just so we can refocus this. But we can remove the motive of profit and still be paid really well.
Right.
Right. But we have to remove all of the other folks. Right. Like right now, I know that if we deploy our Well Life Direct program, where we take one of our not-for-profit or charitable pharmacies that are on site at a what we call a covered entity or not-for-profit qualified health system. So it could be a small disproportionate share hospital. It could be a Ryan White clinic, community health center. It could be a lot of different, a federally qualified health center in rural healthcare. And I say, hey, I want to partner. I want to bring in and create a specialty program for the city, the county employees, public school district, because we want to have that captive audience. We want to create this circuit, some circular healthcare economics, right? Close that drug supply chain. So all of that money that's coming in, all that opportunity is staying in the community. And then there's a broker or a consultant that wants a part of the action, right? Because he's been managing the benefits for one of those institutions. And then what they're doing is they're using our they're trying to use our models to source their prescription drugs, and they're compensating themselves 25 cents of every dollar that's being saved. They're making more than they would have made if they would have taken commission from a health insurance company, right? But like at the end of the day, what value did they, what value constitutes them taking 25% of savings for something that we created? And we need part of that 25 cents to pump into uncompensated care and charitable care. And we got somebody that just because they found an idea and told another person about an idea that they're deserving of 25 cents of every dollar of savings for that institution. It makes no sense, right? There's not that much value there. And so I always got really fired up about those things. And I will say that if you look at, and we'll finish with this, but like in our world, if you look at large specialty pharmacy and the folks that have benefited primarily from the HIV AIDS population, right? People living with HIV and AIDS, right? And you look at how much money they're extracting from those programs. We just picked up a new client, 800 patients, incredible clinic in South Carolina. And oh my gosh, the specialty pharmacy was taking 80 cents of every dollar of federal margin, right? On a 340B program for dispensing fees, administration, to run the pharmacy, a contract pharmacy aspect of this institution. So if that's 80 crazy. Cents of every dollar for that specific program are running out, they were getting less than $1 million on the 250 of patients that were living with HIV and AIDS and had other opportunistic diseases. So you're having your antiretroviral therapies, your PEP, your PrEP, U equals U types of medications to get people to a zero viral load, hepatitis C meds. If you look at all of those meds that were, you're talking about $8 million, right? Worth of 340B drug pricing savings. And they were taking 80% of it to compensate themselves. And in the clinic, the foundation was like, we just never really understood because we were just letting this other organization take care of it. And so that's why we created Well Life, because we said, look, we understand that you don't have the resources. We will finance it. We will give you up to $500,000 to build this.
Yep.
And then we will operate it for 5 years, make it very profitable. You will pay us back out of that. We obviously have our professional fees while we're operating that. Mm-hmm. And then at 5 years, we will continue to support the peripheral services that you will always need. But you own that from day one. We're only taking about 17 cents on a dollar. And our profit margin is great. Wow. Right. So that just tells me we have a system that is absolutely fleecing and stealing from not only public institutions, but from Americans in general.
Just the difference between 17 cents and 80 cents. I'm just trying to get that through my head right now.
Now, that's not always the case, right? That's not everybody. But the reality is that there is a lot of money leaving those communities. And the money that was meant there to take care of uncompensated care, underinsured or uninsured people, charitable programs, people are using those federal and state programs to enrich themselves. Oh. So there's got to be a balance. And we're hired because I think we're good at what we do. But to meet our mission, we also have to be very transparent about the fact that, yes, we are going to make money and we are going to do well.
Yes.
But it's all built on how well the institution that we're serving is doing, right?
Exactly.
If they are not improving their situation financially, clinically, if outcomes are not changing and improving, then we should be fired. Right. Bottom line, we should be fired. If we are not changing the tone and temperature and thoughts and minds of people in the community to do it differently and take those private sector dollars and create a circular economy of healthcare that's ultimately benefiting folks that are in marginalized and vulnerable communities, then what are we doing? Right. Exactly. We are the oath that we took not to harm. It doesn't mean shit. It doesn't. So again, we've refocused that specific to your specialty. And I would say like two things that we need to do in addiction treatment and primary mental health right off the bat: pass patient brokering laws in every state with stiff penalties. Patient brokering, I will tell the audience what it is. Yeah. Two things: patient brokering and honesty in advertising, right? So here's the thing. If you are an inpatient rehab and you have tried to partner with a sober living, and have told that sober living that you are going to compensate them if one of their people relapse and you send them to your facility, that should be illegal. It's not in any other state except for Florida, right? And so it's like that incentive is insane to me. Now, could there be strategic partnerships that are set up, right, that can be transparent, right, where there is relationships that provide a level of compensation? I'm not completely against that, but I can say like straight up, if you've got business development reps out there saying, look, you know, when your guys get out, you know, we want you to send them to our PHP and IOP and we're going to compensate you a percentage of what we're making on that patient through the back door so that you can keep our funnel full, our pipeline of patients full. Bullshit. I call bullshit all day long.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
That is absolutely, I just do. All right. So that's number one. Also truth in advertising, right? That's a big one. So if you are, let's just say an institution that's bringing services in the home, right?
Yep.
So let's say that you're the next level of, we provide clinical and 12-step services or whatever, or some type of concierge program where, you know, you don't need to go to rehab or back into ILP. We're going to come into the home. There's lots of them popping up. But I'm seeing a lot of them. They're brokers, right? Because most of them, they maybe have one clinical supervisor that's just there to sign off so that they can bill. Mm-hmm. And they're actually billing. This is the kicker. They are paying certified recovery coaches, right, to provide 2 hours of service a week. And they are billing for IOP.
Yes.
So they're making $5,000 to $6,000 a month paying. Who knows what they're paying these certified recovery coaches?
I don't know.
You go to their website, they say, we provide DBT, CBT, motivational interviewing, all this crap. They provide none of it. In fact, what they do is they say, we can get you those services, but your insurance is going to be billed by the institution that we referred you to, right? So now I'm paying co-pays for all of that other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So truth in advertising is really important, right? Because what happens is primarily if somebody's coming out of a crisis situation, they show up at a rehab and they're like, wait a second, this isn't what I signed up for. Like, honestly, if you're a 12-step program, be very clear about that, right? If somebody, you know, if somebody has had a bad experience in that, you're not doing them any service by like saying, oh, well, we've got a dual diagnosis program, but you really don't have a dual diagnosis program.
Exactly.
Yes. And they end up at a retreat in the woods being told that, you know, a religious model of a 12-step program is the way in which that they're going to get their healing. Again, all of those things are fine. Just be honest about it, right? That's all that I want. Again, there's no law to protect the patient right now from ending up. And I'm not even going to go because we could just go on forever. I won't even get you started with state programs, right? Where if you have Medicaid, you can only go into certain programs because those might as well be jail or halfway houses, right? Mm-hmm. Because in most cases, and I'm not going to suggest that it's not the same way in some private institutions, but in most cases, those state run programs are just re-traumatizing people.
Oh, of course.
With no solution to deal with trauma. So, I mean, we haven't even, you know, if trauma is the source of addiction, and in many cases it is, you know, we are re-traumatizing people in that. So that's my piece on that very specifically. And then again, that comes back to how we have created. So we ask people to work an honest program and then we lie, right, about what we do, how we get patients, and what we're actually billing for. See it time and time again. And, you know, I, again, don't think that the intent of most institutions is to do that. I think that the system is set up to force people into that situation.
Okay, so the system, I'm so glad that you brought up the whole Sober House Treatment Center thing. It was so interesting. I was watching this video, even with the freaking clients that I worked with, about this video. Yeah, they were kind of knocking treatment centers, but they made a lot of sense where there's this system where, like you said, the residential treatment center will have a relationship with the sober house. It's a revolving door, right? And they have these recovery and mental health advocates literally go out on the streets to find people who are drunk, homeless, intoxicated. Hey, buddy, I think you need like treatment or whatever. How do you feel about that? And again, there's not in the right frame of mind to even give an appropriate answer for themselves. But they'll say, okay, yeah. And the guy will, do you have health insurance? Do you have insurance? You do? Great. Come with me. So they'll send them to the treatment center, and then the treatment center will send them to the sober house. They, let's say, hypothetically, relapse at the sober house, and then they're back out in the streets again. It's a revolving cycle door.
Yeah. And obviously there are people in maximum security prison for the rest of their lives. And Florida was a big issue, right, that we saw. And so there's a lot of trepidation with that. With all that shit talking that I just did, let me be clear with your audience. There is some incredible, incredible inpatient and outpatient programs that are changing lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
I am the recipient of one of them. I'm also the recipient of some incredible sober living, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where men were on a mission to change their life, be honest about who they were, work with other people that were struggling, and they have seen their lives change. So with all that shit talking, I want to kind of bring it back and say, there's a lot of mess out there. And quite frankly, I think it's the majority. But I think if parents are listening, if clinicians are listening, if patients are listening, there are incredible ones out there. Guys like Jacob know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And if Jacob needs a referral, I will send you. And quite frankly, my better half and I, she has a foundation, right, where we can get you into the top-notch ones and scholarship you. I mean, nice. we want to see people whole. I mean, my entire life is wrapped up, and I wouldn't even be having this conversation with you because I would have ended up bankrupt. Mm-hmm. I would have ended up dead, right? All of the consequences that come along with trying to solve a problem in an unhealthy way, I experienced, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of loss, a lot of grief. And then something happened, right? Something that changed my life happened. And I know that you want to talk about it. So, you know, I experienced some significant change in my life. It came after years. As I said, you know, I had a lot of non-use and my life got better, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that I had a real problem until later on in life. I think that using created problems, but right. I was not to that place where there was going to be significant change, right?
Do you believe like addiction could be either genetic or it can also be like a behavior, a negative behavior that is developed through life, let's say through like stress and anxiety?
I don't think that we have enough information.
Yeah.
I mean, to categorically say one way or another. I can tell you for me, I grew up in a relatively stable home, but I can tell you that for me, growing up in a radically religious home was spiritually traumatizing.
Gotcha.
I think the way in which I was raised and the human being that I was early on in life was very different than my brothers. And so I developed coping mechanisms mm-hmm. that turned into behaviors. I was no doubt a product of my environment and I made decisions based on that. But I also had a great grandfather that died of cirrhosis of the liver. So I do think that there was a family history there.
Okay.
Was I born with a propensity? I don't know. I don't ask that question today. Epidemiologically, I think that there are segments of the population that are set up to be in a position where genetic traits are passed on.
Yeah.
I think that our DNA changes as we make certain health decisions in our life, and then we pass those on to our children.
Yep.
I'm not going to categorically say substance use issues are mental health, behavioral health, a learning disorder. This is what I do know. I got to a place where the archaic limbic system part of my brain had been hijacked. Drugs and alcohol were more important than sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Mm-hmm. No, just, you know, it was more important than shelter, was more important than relationships, was more important. And so that prefrontal cortex area, as I always say, I'm like, look, it's like this. It's like playing basketball against Michael Jordan, right?
Yep.
It's a buzzer beater situation. Michael Jordan's always going to get that hit, right? Yep. So as much as we rationalize up here in the prefrontal cortex that these things are a bad decision and we shouldn't pick up, that's why the real alcoholic, the person that really does have a substance use disorder, has a chaotic, you know, relationship with drugs or alcohol. That substance isn't the problem. It just never was. The substance is the solution. It just happens to be a poor solution. It happens to be an unhealthy solution. There is a better way. But I think that societally, we have driven that, right? The war on drugs, right, is a great example of what we've done. We should be have graduated to decriminalization by this point
in our
history. And we are still moralizing those things. I really like to think, you know, my recovery is a spiritual program, right? Are there clinical aspects of it that I 100% have respect for? Absolutely. I'm a clinician, right? Mm-hmm. Clinicians work for me. I have great respect for that. But like with anything, if we talk about how we're going to change the things that are keeping us sick as the solution for not masking a symptom, but actually cure,
yeah.
That's why I don't prescribe to this idea that we're in recovery per se. Mm-hmm. I'm recovered.
Yeah,
I am. I don't think that I have to work a particular step in a program to be recovered. Yeah. I think that I get to decide that. And then I live out a certain routine every single day that keeps me in the center of that. And a lot of that for me is spiritual, but mm-hmm. there are also things like sleep hygiene, going to bed at the same time every night. The way in which I communicate with other people or let other people communicate to me as part of that, creating emotional, mental, spiritual, and physical boundaries in my life that protect me. All of those things can be wrapped up in clinical, but they are also, right, spiritual. Which psychology, what? I mean, the psych part of it is it's psych means soul, right? So it's the study of the soul. So we need to not bring religiosity into a conversation about the soul, but we need to understand that spirituality is that point of, it does not have to contradict science, right?
Yeah.
It does. It we can actually prove science gives us the ability to access other parts of our brain.
Yep.
I practice Kundalini meditation that does some very specific things to my pineal gland that activate certain hormones in my brain, in my pituitary gland.
Yep.
Right. And that releases something that creates an energy about me that allows me to operate in the world differently than I used to. So meditation's been an incredible thing for me. Also, my interpretation in the way in which I apply the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be a lot differently, right? You know, again, I am unapologetic about, you know, that being 12-step being who I am, right? But at the end of the day, if I'm not living in a certain way, then doesn't mean shit for somebody else, right? If I'm not willing to go out of my way to serve others, and believe me, I am the poster child for selfishness, you know, self-centered, self-will run riot. I am that guy. There's no doubt. And I have to reset it every single day because things come out of my mouth and I have to remind myself I'm not that guy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But my sponsor told me early on, right? It just so happened that my sponsor is actually the guy that runs the 12-step corporate program for the rehab that I went to. So it was like I have not had to separate myself from that. But he, first day I met him, he goes, "Ryan, you need a power more powerful than all the powers that we're not powerful enough." And I broke that down as a scientist, right? Okay. And so that's how, so you come back to why did you want to be in epidemiology? Because epidemiology asks questions, right? Yeah. It doesn't settle for answers and then ask you just to believe, right?
Right.
It doesn't. And so our spiritual walk can be the same thing, right?
Yeah.
What did Carl Jung said? He goes, "I always have a hard time with the word belief because by the time I get there, I already know because I've done the work." I'm fully persuaded of that. It's this idea of belief, right? I don't need to believe something, right? I either know it or I don't. And if I know it and it's working for me, then that's mine, right? I take ownership for that. It's not yours. It's not your walk. And so we apply that same thing in rural healthcare, man. We do. We say, look, I was just having a conversation with the Charitable Pharmacies Association of America. And I said, look, let's define equity, inequity, disparity versus closing that gap. And let's change language, right? That's why people, you know, that's why today you have to be very careful about saying, like, labeling yourself, like, I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic. Right. So for the sake of the community that I'm in, right, and the program that has worked for me, I can comfortably say those things, but I don't label myself as that. I don't say, "Hey, my name's Ryan, I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict." No, I say, you know what? I had a life that I didn't want and a life that I did want, and I could not reconcile the two. And it's because I had a chaotic relationship with an external substance that I use as a solution for a problem that was inside of me here and here, right? So I needed both clinical and I needed spiritual, and I don't need to separate the two, right? They can work together. That's why I always tell clinical departments and the spiritual. So if you had a 12-step coordinator and then you've got a clinical advisor, and I say, you guys got to figure out how to work together.
Yeah.
Right. Because you can't be contradicting each other. When you're, you know, especially an inpatient, you can't be contradicting. The message has got to be straight, right? You have to say, we want part of your clinical program, right? And your treatment plan to be for you to find that thing, right?
Yes.
And that thing can be whatever that thing is. But my opinion is that thing's got to be more powerful than you. So it can't be a fucking chair, dude, because I can pick that chair up and throw it. It can't be the group conscience, right? Because the group conscience isn't powerful enough to keep me sober, right? Here's part of the problem with the way in which we have modeled the the 12-step program that I think that there's change. And I think that you can, when you learn this about yourself, you can connect with community in those programs that understand the foundation of it. Mm-hmm. And then criticism is not as big, right? Because there's a lot of people that want to criticize that stuff. Why 12-step is bad, all those things. It's not for me, but I can understand why it is for other people. Because every time when I was trying to figure out how to fix this problem inside of me, and I would walk into a room, I'd be like, there's nobody in this room who has what I want at all. Right. And that's what I was telling you before. I said, look, maybe these people had a spiritual experience, but they're not what we call a real alcoholic, right? They can stay stopped, right? They had a moderate, they're moderates, you know, they're moderates. They're heavies. They created problems in their life, mm-hmm. but they did not have this. They did not have, you know, like Dr. Silkworth gave us this, very archaic, but very useful model that basically says, look, mental obsession, phenomenon of craving, loss of choice, loss of control. And so I believe I had this lack of power, right? The problem is that I was looking for, you know, if I'm an iPhone charger and I let this sucker go down to two, right. then I need to make some phone calls. I need to find a charger that can soup this sucker up quick.
I like that.
Right. There's not going to be this whole process. I'm dying. I don't have 12 months. Right. Mm-hmm. Like we have to come up with a solution now. Right. Yeah. Because I'm going to end up back on the street. Right. So that's like with Well Life, why we promote medication assisted therapy or treatment. Mm-hmm. We will support safe consumption in the states that will allow it. Right. Because I don't care. There's no morality in this for me. Right. It's very relative to me. Right. Because this is about science. This is about what we know and what we don't know. Right. I'm not going to vacillate in this idea of belief. Right. Because for me, faith is knowing. Right. Faith is not believing. Right. And then I be able to take some action steps. So I think this is a good transition to have this conversation that we wanted to have. So what was that pivotal point for me? And people get twisted about this, right? Mm-hmm. They do, especially in the community that I run in. But here's the thing: we have to have the conversation, because for as much as I'm abstinent now, because I can get to a place that I need to get to in my meditation, right? Where I can create an energy and a power in my life that gets me excited to wake up in the morning and ask questions, not only professionally, but personally, treat other people different, to have a different worldview than I've ever had before, to believe that we can make impact and that I have to be the man that empowers people to do so. And that for as much as I might be a bleeding heart liberal, this face is not going to fix a lot of the problems that we have in healthcare. And so I need to figure out what I can do and who I can surround myself with that can be the voice for these issues, because I don't have, there are certain lived experience that I don't have, that I can't speak to, but there are people that work for me that do, and they need to lead that effort. And I let them, because I know that I have maybe the technical solution. I don't have the heart solution for that.
Mm-hmm. But you support
that. I come back to this idea that, what was my experience? So my experience was I took a, what we call a hero's dose, or 5-gram macro dose of psilocybin in the jungle with a shaman.
Beautiful.
And I can tell you, I fought the idea of the universe. I would say maybe I was agnostic, but I was more atheistic for many years. And then I had that experience, right? It was actually I'll give you some clinical right now. There was a study that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine that says for individuals that struggle with binge drinking, which I did, that was my issue. I was not a daily drinker, but when I drank, it was everything that you can imagine, right? It might be 80 in the study, binge drinking, those individuals that had an alcohol use disorder were reduced after taking a macro dose of psilocybin 86%.
Wow. So reduced to they never had the thought of drinking again, or how did that
work? 86% of the population stopped binge drinking. The amount of binge drinking that happened in the population was reduced by 86%.
Oh,
right. So what does that mean? It means less problems. It means more clarity. It means more self-reflection. It means an opportunity to make better choices. And part of those choices may be to go into rehab. Anyways, I had this experience. I won't get into too much of what it looked like other than to say, I saw things, things were revealed to me that would have never been revealed to me before. And as a scientist, as an epidemiologist, as a person that supports clinical remedy, I could not at all deny that something was going on, right?
Yes.
So do I have a religious pursuit in my life? No way. I don't. I respect people that do. I do not. I believe that we are made up of energy. That energy can neither be created, it can either be destroyed, mm-hmm. right? And so I believe in this idea of a quantum life where, you know, the guy that didn't change his life is still living, dealing with the exact same things. And my consciousness allows me to be aware of the decisions that I made in this consciousness. And that's why we're having this conversation today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people might call it hippy dippy shit. For me, it's absolutely worked, right? I have a very, you know, yeah. I work these things out and I see the universe reveal itself to me. And it gives me what I need from it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, whether it's the Dharma, you know, I always say I'm Dharmic in nature. I am a German Jew that's Dharmic in nature that happens yeah. to practice Kabbalism. Right. So I like Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. I like some Judeo-Christian beliefs. I'm not a Paulinist, right? I believe that Jesus was an incredible man? Absolutely. I can get on board with Jesus. I can't get on board with a lot of the other things that do not necessarily mm-hmm. resonate with my soul. Certainly in today's climate, right? It's, you know, a lot of things get hijacked, right? And so yeah. I think that any good thing can be hijacked, right? So I stay away from all of it. Anything that has dogma, doctrine, or theology, I simply say, people say, what do you believe in? I say, that thing yeah. that's going on right there, you know, divine wisdom, an infinite creative energy, a universe that's
mm-hmm.
doing some incredible things for us. And if we wake up to them, then we have this opportunity to see things that we would never see before, see things in different ways,
mm-hmm.
And live a different life. And for me, I needed that, right?
Right.
And so that psychedelic experience, that wonderful, beautiful thing. See, the thing about psilocybin, they call it the child because you take that much of it and then wake up in the morning realizing that it took nothing from you. There is no hangover. You feel better than you have in your entire life. And you know what the crazy part was? As somebody that struggled with substances, I've never used it again. I never chased that because it wasn't a high. It wasn't even, that wasn't the experience. It gives more than it takes. It asks a lot of things from you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It shows you a lot of things. And so that experience, right, I was able to mechanically bring into my belief system, mm-hmm. right, as someone that was not going to connect to a particular religion, but have a very universal spiritual practice and say, this works, right? And then this guy who had criticized 12-step for years and years and years for yeah. a million different, I might say, some very legitimate reasons.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, I could see that, yeah. Not everybody struggled the way that I struggled.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody could just put down the drink and show up to meetings and have success.
Right.
It was never going to be about that. That it was about this idea that whatever this, you know, and again, we're talking spiritual things. We've gone off the beaten trail. But for me, it was, I knew I needed a power greater than myself, but I needed a power more powerful than that power that was greater mm-hmm. than myself. And I would not, I don't believe, had a point of reference for that if I wouldn't have had that psychedelic experience. I stand by that. I'm not unashamed of it. I don't apologize for it. I'm certainly not seeking out magic mushrooms today. I am not looking to, you know, Rick Doblin, as we've talked about in the past with MAPS, is doing some incredible stuff with MDMA, and they're headed in phase 4. And we're going to see, we've seen some incredible things out of psychedelics, and we were going to, and they need to be instituted. I love the idea of clinicians having access to those things. Ketamine, MDMA, all of these things I think are beautiful. They're beautiful to be able to open up, but I don't think that they're beautiful without integration, right? That's why I would never, ever, ever use psilocybin out of a sacred ceremonial type of situation.
Yeah.
Because these things are not recreational, right? Because I know what recreational did for me. I know what seeking out an externality did to solve an internal problem, right? So these beautiful indigenous plant medicines open us up to ask and answer questions, to have things revealed about ourselves so that we can integrate with a professional. And I think that that's where we need to be. I do
also
have a fear.
There's got to be access to those plants. I mean, it's not cheap to go all the way over there to get to have the experience you had. Am I correct?
No, it's not. It's not cheap. It was super expensive. But again, that speaks to my privilege and something that I recognize today and something that I have to figure out what to do with. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm doing the right thing. But yeah, it is. I can get on a plane and go. And I know that.
And I would love for everyone to have that experience, you know?
And I think so. I think with the Pacific Northwest, Colorado, what's happening, I think that people will be able to. Here's the thing. My only concern or only fear is that we allow the pharmaceutical industry to hijack indigenous plant medicine and sell it back to us for shit tons of money. I am concerned about that. I don't like that idea. I think that there needs to be a balance in that. I don't think that it needs to be ground up, synthesized, put in a pill and dispensed at a pharmacy. I don't. I think it needs to be a unique spiritual or clinical relationship that only the practitioner and the patient or the guide and the human in that situation, it's a private relationship that happens out. I am concerned about it. I am 100% concerned about Congress actually having a conversation about it. I'm not going to lie. Do I think it's great that we're going to have access to it? And that's the channel in which we have to go. Here's the problem. We still have a drug war. And until the federal government says up to 2 ounces, any drug, we don't care what it is, you're not going to be incarcerated for, I'm going to have trepidation about it. Because quite frankly, all it tells me is now more people are going to go to jail, right? Yeah. Over substance seeking.
Over something that should be a beautiful, loving experience. You know, they're going to take something beautiful and make it ugly. Different way to look at it.
I agree. I mean, I agree. I think we haven't solved for it yet. I think guys like Rick Doblin have committed their entire lives to this type of pursuit. And I just don't want us 40 years from now to be saying, I wish it would have never been that way, because the federal government has used it against us. You know, so where I may be for socialized medicine, universal healthcare coverage, integration of indigenous plant medicines in that process, and I am, I still have a healthy respect for the idea that there can be overreach and there has to be a balance. And we don't, I think it's colonialism. I mean, at the end of the day, whether it's global public health and what I see with the big three management consulting firms using their influence and money to colonize healthcare in low and middle income countries, or large corporations that have foundations that on paper look beautiful, that simply they're just pumping money into those secondary markets to, they're giving money to open up markets for themselves. We live in that world.
Yep.
I don't know that we have to accept it. I think it's one of the things that, you know, we say, accept the things we cannot change, encourage to change the things we can, and there was no difference. I think that is a situation where we say, bullshit, I am not going to accept the things I cannot change. I'm going to change the things I cannot accept.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that we have an opportunity to do that collectively.
Yes.
Right. In the healthcare community, we can make those decisions. We have to decide that managed care is not making these decisions for us. And we need to find the big boys. I mean, that was the beautiful part about starting Well Life. I knew again that there was only so much capital that we were going to be able to expend to be able to get to the finish line. So I needed to find some big boys to come to the table and say, look, you need optics. We need support. And so I don't care what your motivation is. Because where we need to be able to control this, keep people honest, have a level of integrity about it. Yeah, we do.
Amen.
We need to be Robin Hood. We need to get this shit done. We need to be bold. We need to be unapologetic about our motivation to change. Mm-hmm. We need to stop taking status quo as acceptable. And we are. There may be some great conversations that are going on, but until we stop legislating the rights of our people away from them, from women's healthcare to the rights of the LGBTQ plus community to our ability to be able to navigate healthcare in a apolitical way, we're going to continue to struggle with it.
It's true.
There is going to be a lot of performance art happening, and I have to check myself on it because I get fired up about these issues, Jacob, but I have to every single day ask myself, am I being of help or am I being of harm, right? Yeah. Am I being performative about these things, or am I going into the trenches and helping dig the ditch? And am I being the ally that the universe has called me to be? And I have to ask that question daily because it's easy to get off track, right? It is absolutely easy to get off track.
And another thing too, you ask yourself, am I being truthful to who I am? Am I living by my values?
Yeah, I do want people to be genuine, their genuine, authentic self. I think that we have to tell hard truths sometimes.
Not being afraid to hurt other people's feelings.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a balance. I want to make sure that, like, obviously, I've said some things that could be perceived as outrageous over the course of the last hour and a half, but that I can tell you this, I 100% care about what the future looks like, primarily in healthcare. Mm-hmm. I do have an epidemiologist's view of it. I do have musings, right, about what that looks like, about degrowth, about regeneration, about this idea that we can't deal with public health, global health, or one health until we deal with planetary health. We've got to care about a lot more than how the system is impacting us directly. And by us, I mean collectively as humans, because it's negatively impacting Black, Brown, and LGBTQ plus communities mm-hmm. far more than it's impacting anybody else. It's not to say that there aren't some significant issues in white communities that are struggling economically, that don't have access, but that's not the majority of the issue. But we have to tackle all of these things, but it comes down to access. It comes back to motivation, like I've said before. And I want to make sure that when the rubber hits the road, that not only personally, but professionally, people know that I understand that my intent has to be lived out, that there has to be action. The intent doesn't mean shit, quite frankly, Jacob. I intend to do good things all the time. Doesn't mean that I do them, right? And so there has to be action. And if I see myself personally, professionally, or my team not living in the center of the solution, then we redirect. Because again, we have a lot of great research, a lot of great academics that work with us. We need all of that information. Mm-hmm. But we do not have enough people digging ditches. We do not have enough people executing and implementing the solution on a lot of different fronts, whether it be in infectious disease, chronic disease, rare disease, mental health, substance use, addiction treatment. And we know the answers. We know what the right thing is 9 times out of 10. Many times we just choose not to do it, right? Because it impacts our paycheck. It impacts our pocketbook. It impacts our bottom line.
Yep.
And I'm here to suggest that it doesn't have to, right? That there can be a balance, that we can actually have some equality, that we can have equity, but society is going to have to change. I don't want to wait for the offenders to die to see that change. I don't want to have to wait for the kids that are younger than us, Jacob, to be leading our government. Because for me, it will be too late, right?
Right.
And so that means that part of that action is political. I wish it wasn't. I wish we could just leave that out of healthcare, but it has to be. We have to vote people that care about women, that care about people that aren't white, cisgendered, straight guys, right? We have to do that. We have to understand that religious freedom means for everyone in healthcare and in life, that our spiritual pursuits are our own, and that we can share our successes and paths without being critical of others.
And not condemned for it.
We can own who we are, be our authentic, genuine self, and not trample on others at the same time. That's not necessary. That's not what I'm called to do. I don't think that anybody else is. I think that sometimes we do. It wasn't our intent to, right? Our great ideas, right, get in the way of and are harmful of other people having the lives that they should have. And so we have to be careful about those things. And so I know we talked about a lot, and obviously I am not short of words on a lot of things as it relates to these topics. But at the end of the day, I try to stay in my lane as it relates to my lived experience, right? The skills and the resources that I have that I can bring to the table so that I can make Holden Fitzgerald a different type of global public health practice. Mm-hmm. So we can be boots on the ground, right? So that I'm more concerned about vaxes and jabs in the arm,
yep,
and providing access and clean water and solutions on the ground. And I don't need to give, you know, I don't need to be in the business of charging thousands and thousands of dollars, mm-hmm, for a 40-page pontification, right, a strategic plan. It's like, great, you know, yeah, you've solved the problem. Who's going to take care of it? Because we don't have the resources to do it, right? We have to be there. We have to be in the center of it. That's where the solution is. The solution is never in telling people what the solution is. It is about teaching people what the solution is and then helping them walk it out, whether it be in healthcare, whether it be to get people to a place where they can be recovered, right, from a mental health state of distress, of disease, in their mental health, in the way in which they deal with their chaotic relationships with externalities, whether it may be substances, whether it may be relationships, whatever it might be. It will never be in us just saying, oh, well, we gave you the solution. Why didn't you just do it? I call bullshit on that, Jacob.
Amen.
We can't be that human. We cannot be the guy that says, well, I told you so, right? And I can't be that because I spent many years being told what I should do and no one ever showing me, right?
Yep.
And when somebody did, the light bulb went off, my life changed, yes, and I've never been the same. I've never been the same professionally. I've never been the same personally. And for that, I'm grateful.
Beautiful thing. It is. Well, again, Dr. Ryan, it was such an honor and blessing having you on the show, man. I greatly appreciate it so much.
And yeah, you're welcome.
And if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there like a particular number, email, website they could use to make contact with you?
Yeah. If you want to go to HoldenFitzgerald.com, you can get in contact with me through the contact page. Right. That is the easiest way. I am always available. Or you can find me on LinkedIn. My URL is Ryan Paul HF. You can find me on LinkedIn. Please connect with me there. Otherwise, HoldenFitzgerald.com or LinkedIn. My URL is Ryan Paul HF. Would love to connect with anybody. Always will make time for someone. It's easy as just getting on my calendar for 30 minutes and us having some discourse about what can we do to help you and your organization, or how can I personally help you in your individual walk as we hopefully all together, as you know, as a collective, as humanity, do better with what we have, that we can be better stewards with the gifts that we've been given, for sure.
Amen. And to all my listeners, I will make sure I put the information on my show notes, so it'll be one click away.
Thanks, Jacob. Appreciate it, brother.
Great pleasure.
I again want to thank Dr. Ryan Paul for being an awesome and amazing special guest. The show was great, very knowledgeable, and I had so much fun. I cannot wait to work with Dr. Ryan in the future. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.